Welcome to Conversations of the Strange.
Conversations of the Strange.
Welcome to another episode of Conversations of the Strange. I am on the phone with a wonderful writer and probably one of the newest people I've had the chance to meet. And I got to tell you, this person is cool. I mean, really, really, really cool. I mean, if you think you've ever met someone that's cool, not as cool as this person that I'm talking to right now. And I am so thrilled to have Mitzi Sorretto on the phone. And we are talking about her new anthology, The Best New True Crime Stories Focusing In on Serial Killers. Ms. Sorretto has a strong background in writing. She has written in many genres, such as crime fiction, cozy mystery, gothic fiction, sci-fi fantasy, parody, satire, erotic fiction, genre fiction, dark fantasy, paranormal, romance, horror, humor, southern fiction, apocalyptic, and post-apocalyptic. And also at the same time, she is the mother to a very, very, very famous mystery solver, and his name is Teddy Teddaloo. And if you have not heard about his mysteries, then you are missing out on some really, really fun writing. And right now, let's just jump right in and have a conversation with our new friend Mitzi and just say, Mitzi, I want to thank you so much for being on the phone and thank you for joining us today, or technically Skype. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Don. And also, Teddy says thank you for the plug, because he often feels left out with this true crime gig. You know, he can't sort of get his paw in, so to speak.
Understandable. And the thing is that what I have learned is that you want to keep your teddies on your positive side, because teddies are just absolutely, utterly awesome. Without getting too much into it, let's just say one came in very handy for me last week when I had a very rough time, and that's actually very true on that subject. So I'm a big fan of teddies, so I am really glad that I can say something nice about your friend.
Well, I appreciate that, because, you know, with this quarantine business, you know, he's not able to get to the pub. So, he gets a bit testy without having his, you know, pint once in a while.
Exactly. Gotcha. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about, I want to get the title right, The Best New True Crime Stories, which what I love about this is that you have basically created a series of genres almost. And if I could very, very twistedly compare it to the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, where you've got Chicken Soup for the Soul and you've got like some focusing on great teacher stories, grandmother stories, puppy stories, teddy bear stories. You're focusing in on crimes. So your first book is obviously focused in on serial killers, and I believe you've got a second one coming out in July dedicated to, Is it Southern?
No, that's small town.
Small town. Yeah, small town murders, or small town crime, I should say.
And yeah, well, there's lots of murder. But
exactly. And I wanted to ask, what inspired this? Because you've got such a strong fictional background. Why go into this direction with your writing?
Well, I have done nonfiction before. I've actually edited a couple of nonfiction anthologies in the past, and I actually, you know, did have a journalism background and did my undergrad studies in journalism. So I kind of had the groundwork was laid, so to speak. But the true crime, it was one of those things that happened by accident. I was just brainstorming ideas with a publisher who I had worked with in the past and who had gone to another house. And, we were just chatting about ideas and, you know, we'd worked together really well in the past, and she really wanted to get me, you know, get something jump started. And true crime was just something that came up, and I never shy away from a challenge, and I put my all into something, and I said, yeah, I'll come up with something that will, you know, th- that hopefully everyone is going to be really pleased with. And that's really how it came about.
Gotcha. Now, when you're, did you, forgive me for asking this, you contributed a couple of the stories, am I correct?
Yeah, I wrote a story, obviously. I always contribute to my own anthologies. That's the perk of being the boss.
Right, right, exactly.
I don't reject my own work.
Exactly. That's pretty funny. You write yourself back. I go, please know that your submission has been accepted. Never has a writer been as good looking.
Thank you so much for your story, but I'm afraid we can't use it.
Moping around the house, going to Teddy. You know what? That jerk refused my story. Man, if when I get a hold of her, is she going to be sorry? So.
Yeah, so I wrote a piece for this serial killer's book, and of course for the next one. And you know, when I've done fiction anthologies, I also wrote an original piece for all of those as well. So it's just I think I am a writer, and
right.
Okay, fine, I'm the editor of the book, but I mean, I certainly do want to write a piece as well. It just makes sense to me.
Right. Let me ask something in a very odd way. Let's just say we're gonna take two anthologies. One fiction, not one nonfiction. You've got your fiction one. There's obviously a theme to it. There's always a theme to 90% of the anthologies out there, whether it's like a bunch of writers that got together and just said, let's release it, or it's you take like a theme of like, oh, this is set during a zombie apocalypse, or this is, or zombies have to be a part of something, or something like that. When you're doing something like this, what is quicker to write? Is it quicker to write a fiction story, or is it quicker to write a true crime story?
I'll be honest with you. True crime is a hell of a lot of work. Nonfiction in general is very labor intensive. I mean, you know, when you're writing fiction, you could just go off on a tangent. And yeah, fiction is hard work as well, but you have so much creative freedom. When you're working in nonfiction or true crime, you have facts that you have to deal with because these are real events, these are real people. You have a sense of responsibility as you're telling the story because you always need to be aware that some of these people may still be out there, or their family members, their friends, whatever. So there's just a huge responsibility that goes with it. And the research, you know, research is a huge part of this. And you can't just go to one source. You need to check and check and cross check. It's very time consuming. And then of course, when you've got all your information together, you need to create a coherent form of creating a story that isn't going to be dry and putting people to sleep.
Right.
So it's a lot going on.
Right. Stupid question on this. Did you do you guys cite your sources in this anthology? Was that ever considered a part of that? Just like, you know, like if you wrote about like it was mentioned Jack the Ripper. Do you ever go back and like list like London newspapers where you got the information from? Because like thanks to newspapers.com, you can jump on there and see the original articles that were written as if you were there back in the 1880s when everything was occurring.
You know, I left it up to my writers. The serial killer's book has several authors who did cite their sources and you know, did a little bibliography. But it was totally a voluntary thing. I have noticed that, you know, some true crime writers, you know, don't necessarily do that, or they may cite a source in the piece itself. And I didn't want to have people get bogged down with, you know, dealing with Chicago style and all this citation.
Right, right.
I left it up to them. You know, some of the people who maybe are a bit more academic background are sort of honed to always do their referencing. But when I did the second book, I found that almost only one person, I think it was just one person, bothered with doing it. And I didn't even want to bother with it at that point.
Right, so. Right. Yeah, because I had written a history book about a murder that occurred that I'm constantly like going back to. And what has amazed me is that the amount of information that comes back out after the fact of that, where you'll find out like in the book, it's called The Gothel Road Murders. And it was a story about a guy that was his name was Judge John Van Winkle, beloved in the community, and he was murdered by his former ranch hand. and the ranch hand was found, tried, and convicted, and executed. Well, I wrote the entire book, and I wrote it out, and it was did pretty well, and it was an interesting experience. Well, the thing was is that when he was executed, he was hung. What I didn't realize was how he was hung, and I ended up writing a whole other article on the subject in the last couple of months because thanks to newspapers.com, all this information came out about that I hadn't realized. Like when you see an execution, like in the movies and stuff, 9 times out of 10, person's on a platform and the floor drops out, and then that's what kills the criminal. Well, what I found out was he was actually what they call the jerk and pull way of executing, where he was pulled up into the air. And so I wrote a whole article about that because I didn't find out about it until I had access to a bunch of New York newspapers, and they had sent reporters down to cover the execution, and they actually talked with the prisoner beforehand that I did not have access to. And I just looked at that and I was like, where the heck was this 10 years ago when I wrote this book? So it's fascinating, all the info that comes out.
Well,
So.
sometimes there's just like they're ongoing stories. I mean, especially if it's a more contemporary piece, like the one that I have coming out in the Small Towns book. I mean, I thought I had finished my story, and then suddenly I found out that there was another court case that was just like just at the before the new year, and that was something that I needed to integrate into the story. And I'm, by the time the book's published, God knows there might be another, little facet to the story that keeps continuing. So that's the one thing is if it is something that's more contemporary, it's kind of a story that's just going to constantly write itself, and you have to be prepared for that.
Right. Even if I may use this as an example, the O.J. Simpson case, you pretty much thought like you cannot end the O.J. Simpson story with him, the murder case, with him being exonerated for it because there was so much cultural fallback or fallout on what occurred. It wasn't just a case of, oh, okay, he was considered not guilty. What happened to him? And then you find out that like Furman had a whole bunch of things happen to him after the fact. Ito, same thing with Judge Ito, and then OJ himself later on, he ends up going to jail for like I think like threatening people and stealing his trying to steal his merchandise back. And
Robbery.
yeah, exactly. So even then, it's not like you can just like if you had written the definitive book on the OJ case, you're going to get more stuff on it and everything, and
It'll
especially with
never be definitive until maybe he's been dead 100 years and everyone else is dead. Then it might be the definitive book.
right, exactly. So, I mean, there's a level of that. I wanted to ask, one of the things that was really fantastic that you had the chance to do was you wrote an article for the Strand magazine called "Is True Crime Good for You?" And you placed it, and there's a link to it on your website. And let me, I sh we should be plugging your website. It is Mitzi Sirotto, and I'm going to spell it out: MITZISZERETO.com. And people can find that and also a list of a wonderful group of charities that you work with there. And we're going to talk about those in a few minutes. But they get to see all your works. They get to see pictures of you. They also get to see pictures of that very awesome Ted Tetalu as well. And so they get to see all that. And also, I want to encourage everyone to subscribe to your newsletter as well, too. They can easily sign up for it. And you've got all your social.
It hardly ever comes out, so no one will be bothered by too many news.
Nice. Now, when in your article, Is True Crime Good? You talked about one of two things. You talked about how women are very huge true crime followers because they get an education on kind of like there is a level of, now, what happened to the victim here? Was this person not going in a well-lit area? Should they have parked in a well-lit area when somebody came and jumped them? And you kind of go in that direction on that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more on that, about how women have become such true crime fans, and specifically the subject of, is it like they're learning from the mistakes that that other people have made, whether it be good or ill. And not to sound like we're throwing any of the victims under the bus, but you can kind of go, well, what can we do to not put ourselves in a situation that could be potentially harmful for us?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, especially in serial killer cases, nobody necessarily, the victims didn't necessarily do anything foolish or wrong or thoughtless that put them in the position. I mean, serial killers are pretty extreme anyways, you know, but it's really sort of learning through what has happened to others, you know, maybe perhaps like things to watch out for, things that just don't seem quite right or feel quite right. It sharpens one's senses a little bit, you know, about, you know, say somebody's behavior or just whatever. I mean, I think that's more like it. It's one of the reasons perhaps people are interested in true crime in general and you know, kind of consume all these books and all these television programs, because it's just like you think, well, you know, these are real people. This could be me. This could be my friend. It could be my neighbor. It could be my sister or partner or whatever. So it just is an educational thing in many respects. Plus, it's just absolutely fascinating stuff.
Right.
And women are big readers anyways. I think statistically they still do outnumber men as far as being readers of books. So, you know, if they are reading lots of true crime, perhaps that's just a natural progression.
Right, right. Now, without getting too far, I don't want to do any spoilers for your anthology, but I wanted to ask, when you're putting all the stories together, there was two things that I have discovered that are truthful about any sort of true crime. Our true crime story. One of them is, it seems to be that most serial killers that are caught because of something really, really stupid. Like when you're watching a movie and you see the guy, like the hero of the movie or that detective, or, you know, it's always that one detective that's been kicked off the case and he's going at it alone and he's a rogue cop that's going to stand against the bureaucracy and save the day. There's always that. And then he remembers one thing, like that always happened on Murder, She Wrote, where somebody remembered one thing at the very last second. They would go, oh yeah, that's right, we saw a green piece of paper, and didn't we see Jack with green paper that day too? Quick, go get Jack. And it leads to a big shootout, chase, blah blah blah. But it seems that most of the people that are caught, they're caught because they got pulled over for not driving with a driver's license, or having forgotten their registration, or they didn't bury their victim too far and they left a lot of DNA and they traced it all back. Have you found that with the people that were caught in your story or in the stories?
You know, the pieces in this book are from lots of different time frames. So obviously, you know, forensics has improved incredibly in recent years and whatnot. So it's probably a little easier to find some of these people now. But, you know, serial killers in general have a sense of hubris, you know, and I suppose they just get overly confident, and that's how you make stupid mistakes.
Gotcha. Now, the other thing that I have found is that there's almost sort of like a if you've got like a true crime and something that has not been solved in X amount of years, whether it be two or three decades, I have found that 9 times out of 10, that the person that ends up getting arrested, like they solved the crime like decades after the fact, there's always, they were somebody that appeared early on in the files. You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of one of those things where it's sort of like, Jimmy was found dead, let me go question his roommate Steve, and Steve denies it, and somehow or another they don't pursue it later on. But then when they do DNA tests 30 years after the fact, and then they compare it with Steve's DNA, they're like, oh wow, well, turns out Steve did kill Jimmy. And that's the other thing that I have found is that the cases that are cold cases, they have the criminals already listed in there, but the investigator does not have the information to connect the criminal with the crime, or they don't have enough information, or something else has passed. Have you found that with some of these true crimes?
Well, you know, some of them were pretty obvious who was responsible, but I mean, there are, you know, a couple of pieces in here where you don't actually know. It's not quite been solved, and there's theories about who it could be. These are not necessarily the most contemporary. They'd be going back a few years, but, you know, I mean, DNA evidence has changed the dynamic entirely. I mean, years and decades later, as you're saying, that you can actually solve a crime, even if the perpetrator is dead, you can still solve a crime and at least, you know, check it off your list and put paid to it and resolve it for everyone who was involved. So, I mean, but, you know, there's a story in the book, which I don't want to give too much away, but the person who was convicted of the crime and who said till his dying day that he never, he was, you know, he's put in prison for the crime, and he denied that he ever committed these crimes. There's a huge likelihood that this person was not the perpetrator. So as of now, nobody's actually investigating it. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I actually just interviewed her the other day for Facebook Live, but it's the connecting the dots story about the killing of Native American women in Minneapolis. And, you know, that's a case where it doesn't seem as if anybody's looking.
Right. Right. Gotcha.
You know, they supposedly found their man, but it's not, there was evidence that it wasn't him. So.
Right, exactly.
It could go in the other direction, you know.
Yeah, exactly. As you're working on this and writing this, did you ever want to just kind of take a break from the anthology for a couple of days just to go, like you would read about one person's account of what occurred? You had mentioned in a lot of the promotional material, Jack the Ripper. And if anybody ever read about what occurred to the final victim in the what you would call the five, quote-unquote, five Ripper victims, you would read, like the previous women were just straightforward stabbed, and then this woman was just, the fifth one was just absolutely, like, gutted. It's horrifying to read what occurred to her. And you're, like, reading that. Do you ever just find yourself going, okay, I know what I'm doing with this anthology, but I need to just go back and read Dr. Seuss for like a couple of days, or just like watch PBS Kids just to focus in on something that's not this? Did you ever have to kind of step away from the work for a little bit just to kind of go, all right, I'm okay, let me go back to it and then work at it? Because like when you read some of this stuff, it just is absolutely horrible. Like, it can be very horrifying type of thing.
Well, you know, it's not like I had, say, 100 stories that I read through in one day. You know, I mean, I had a call for submissions that was out for some time, and stories would just start trickling in, and the ones that I pretty much knew I wanted to use, you know, it'd be like maybe week 10, okay, I want this one, week 12, I want that one, that sort of thing. So it wasn't like I was just being bombarded with having to just read through this just constantly. So, I mean, I think there really was a break in between. So I didn't necessarily feel overwhelmed by it, you know?
Right.
Because it's not, because I don't save stories to the deadline. I don't like say, okay, submissions deadline is such and such a date, and I'm not even going to look at anything till that date. I don't do that. First of all, time wise, that's insanity to try to do that.
Right.
And it would probably affect my ability to properly, you know, take stories. You know, when a story came in that I really was pretty confident about, I immediately would shortlist it. And some of them I knew so well that I wanted them, I went ahead and already gave an acceptance to. So, I mean, there was plenty of break in between. There was plenty of breathing space.
Gotcha. What about creative-wise? Just like, again, when you're dealing with, like, what you were talking about with the story is that you're writing this and you're going, and Jack the Ripper killed how many victims? Let me go back, read five. killed five victims. Their names were, got to go back. Did you ever find yourself just going, let me step away from this story for a couple of days and then just start putting some work into something fictional just to kind of feel like, okay, I can knock out 1,000 words in a half hour, whereas when you're writing a true crime story, you're lucky if you can get more than about 300 words without having to go back and look at the facts of the case.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, it's very time consuming to write a true crime piece. I mean, to write one that's a good one, you know. I was actually working on a fictional book that I had to shelve. Unfortunately, this poor book has been shelved so many times over the years. And that's when I started to work on the true crime book. So I'll be honest with you, it's as if the true crime has absorbed pretty much all of my time. Because as I said, I kind of work as I do things as I go along. You know, when I knew I wanted a story, I would begin with the editing process, the fact checking, going back and forth with the writer and discussing if, you know, I thought perhaps there needed to be another, you know, some added dimension to it or some suggestions. So it just seemed, if you ask me where the time went, I don't know where it went, but, it just seemed as if this absorbed pretty much everything.
Right.
You know?
Right. Because that's the other thing is that it's just sort of like there's this level of like you've got to constantly think about what's the next step, what's the next step, until you get to the point where you're like, all right, everything's edited. And you're just kind of like, oh, wow, I'm done. Okay, on to something else. Like there is no like I imagine that for some people when they're writing, there is a level of like, hallelujah, I'm done. And we can kick back and celebrate, grab a glass of wine, high five your teddy bear, that type of thing. But with other people, it's just kind of like, yeah, I finished it. Okay, that's weird. It's a strange
yes.
thing.
Yes, it's the latter. It's like, oh God, it is actually done. Yeah, oh my God, it's done. I mean, seriously, that's really what it was like. And then, of course, because there's writers in here and everybody's on their own time and they have their own other obligations, they may not just be sitting here 24/7 waiting to hear from me. You know, I try to give people a fair amount of time to come back with revisions or to check something, you know, because I want them to, you know, do a really good job, of course. And they want to make sure what's going into print is going to be as perfect as it can be. So, you know, I have to try to accommodate people, and I've got people all over the world, and, you know, sometimes somebody might have gone away for a month and, you know, isn't I. So it's just, there's yeah. just so many, it's like a lot of juggling.
Right. Right. Now, when you've just finished with these two true crime stuff, are you going to jump back to, fiction just to kind of give yourself a palate cleanser?
Well, I mean, there are projects, as I've mentioned, that are fiction that I really have wanted to develop. And I was planning to get back to that famous shelved book. And then the other day, I got an idea for another piece of fiction that I'm quite excited about. And I'm thinking, I know I hate to shelf this thing again. And, you know, Teddy, of course, wants his new book
right.
to be written as well. And I mean, this is years late on that one. But I'm kind of keen on getting stuck into trying to put that together. And then it's, of course, you know, being this is a series, The Best New True Crime Stories, I'm in discussion about a third book. So, you know, that could end up coming around the corner too. So,
right. Were you guys careful to find stories that have not made it to print or that have not been in as many discussions as people have had? Are you looking for stories that were just kind of a little bit off the beaten path, or were you looking for like, or let's do a reexamining of like popular serial killers? Like, were you just kind of like, do we really need another story on the Unabomber or something like that? Like, how did you approach that?
Well, you know, true crime is big, and there are a lot of cases that there has been so many discussions of, so many books written about, so many television series produced, and it's like, well, if there are going to be some so-called superstar serial killers in the book, we need something that is going to give it a different spin, a different approach. So that was one of the things. I mean, obviously I wanted some recognizable people in the book, but I mean, obscure was great. I mean, I was very happy to get in the non-household names. And when I wrote my own story, I made sure that I found something that was not a household name from somewhere that no one would even think about. So of course I'm really excited when I get something like that in, but the ones that are on cases that are quite known, like Fred and Rosemary West, Dr. Harold Shipman, they're written in a way that it's not like rehashing the same old, same old. And right. That's the one thing I wanted to avoid. I just wanted to at least sound fresh. The stories were all written for this book, so this is not any kind of reprints or anything like that. I want to stress that. They're all original pieces.
Right, exactly. Because, well, I would imagine it, like, you would have to come up with something brand new. Like, if I were to say to you, hey, I want to write about John Wayne Gacy, it's been done. Well, here's another perspective that you haven't heard from. Oh, that's interesting. Yes, bring it into the book. So I imagine that
exactly.
There's that type of thing. So it's sort of like, can you take something that has been done over and over and over again? Like, again, somebody like Jack the Ripper. The big thing with Jack the Ripper is there's a level of almost like Ripper of the Year. Like, what famous person that lived in the 1880s can we say was Jack the Ripper? And whether it makes sense or not, you just go like, oh, okay, so that guy was Jack the Ripper. Okay, then another book comes out saying some other person was completely different from Jack the Ripper. It's like the only person that I have heard that it has like so many differences has been that, like, if you were to compare like the amount of people that supposedly killed JFK versus the amount of people that supposedly was Jack the Ripper, it's staggering how many different organizations and individuals were behind both killings or something like that.
Well, I mean, you know, I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, we were saying about serial killers, how you know, they could possibly just leave where they initially struck and start up at a totally different location or totally different place. And the ones like in this in my book that is open-ended, which is the Glasgow's Bible bashing serial strangler, that one wasn't technically solved, but there are some theories that perhaps I've read that it's possible they think he might have ended up being the Yorkshire Ripper. So who knows? You know, there's just like something fairly recently came up about that. So, you know, it's just they don't necessarily stay in the same place. I mean, in my true crime book, the Small Towns book, there's a story of that where somebody had actually left his complete, you know, his area. And many, many, many years later, there's a high probability he was a serial killer of a different sort.
Oh, interesting. Did their modus operandi change? Because that's the big thing that I have heard on the subject, because there is one person that claims that a serial killer from the United States was actually Jack the Ripper, but the problem is the serial killer from the United States would do his victims in one way, and Jack the Ripper did them in another way. And it's usually usually the serial killer, like, if he's kind of what you were talking about, like, if he's, like, say, in some place like Columbus, Ohio, he's killing people one way, and then if he's moving to Des Moines, Iowa, he'll kill them almost in the exact same pattern, in the exact same way that he did in Ohio, as opposed to, okay, you know what, I used a knife here, let me use a chainsaw here type of thing. It just, based on everything that I've read on the subject, stuff like that just doesn't happen.
No, I mean, generally you would figure their modus operandi is the same, but in the specific case that I'm referring to, that's in the Small Towns book, we're talking about many decades having passed from someone going from a 15-year-old boy to being a man who is, I believe, 60-ish. So, you know, that's a lot of time that if this is the same person who was committing these serial killings in another area decades, many decades later, you know, that's a long time for their whole mental processes and whatever it is that they get off on to change.
It makes sense. It really does. You read, all one has to do is just take a look. There's a story in the Alcoholics Anonymous big book about how there was a guy that drank way too much when he was 25, and he said, "Oh, if I drink a lot, then I'm going to mess up my life." And so he basically said, "I am not going to drink while I am working." And so for like the next 30 years, he was at this job, didn't drink a thing. But then when he retired, he got back into it, and he ended up within about 3 or 4 years, ended up dying of cirrhosis of the liver and everything like that. So there is kind of this level of the more extreme behaviors and the more obsessive behaviors. It isn't uncommon for someone to just kind of put it on the back burner for the next couple of decades or something like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's been cases too where maybe it looked like somebody had disappeared or vanished, and then, I can't think of any cases offhand, but I've heard about them where they find out, maybe the person had been seriously ill for many years, or moved to a different part of the world. So it's just like sometimes the supposed calming down isn't necessarily a calming down, or there could be a reason for it that they were unable to continue in their quote pursuit
Yeah,
unquote.
exactly. I have heard basically what it boils down to is that no one just ups. Like the thing with the one thing that is kind of universally agreed with Ripperologist and Jack the Ripper is those five women were not the first or the last. There was usually something leading up to it in some way, those five, and then something after it. It was sort of like they were, well, to use a phrase that's popular these days, at the top of the curve or something like that. It was sort of like this is like there was actions leading up to it, and then obviously actions leading down to it type of thing. It's like, did the Ripper like contract something and die, and that's why the murders stopped, or did the murders occur someplace else, and this guy
Or
just.
perhaps imprisoned for something else, like like burglary or whatever, and was, locked up for years. That's been something that's happened as well.
Yeah, exactly, that type of thing. So you just see all kinds of cases like that. So it's really, really quite fascinating. So,
Yeah,
but
I can't see that a serial killer is just going to stop cold turkey. So, I mean, it's just, I think once you've crossed that line, I don't see how you could go back.
No, not at all. Just to kind of completely change things, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your career. How did you get started in writing in the first place?
Well, I've written for since childhood. We were chatting earlier, that I've always been very creative, and I had several creative balls in the air, so to speak. I was an artist. I wrote. I played music. Instruments. I even wrote songs. And I figured I was going to be creative as an adult, and I just wasn't sure which it was going to be. I was gravitating toward fine art as a career, with writing being as a possible number two. And then I was, did all my university studies and whatnot, and I just started to write. But I was also painting at the same time, and I sold a book first, and that was pretty much the deciding factor for me. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Nice. So if you had actually sold the painting first, I would be talking to you about your famous portraits of true criminals that you have painted with other people. That would
Who
be.
knows? Who knows? I mean, that's really funny to think about, because they're both really very difficult
Right.
professions. They're hard. There's the competition, the trying to make a living. I mean, they're really, really difficult. I mean, we do not live in an age where the artist is as respected as they once were.
No.
We sort of have a lot of people running around calling themselves writers and artists and whatnot, and they're not necessarily the case. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I could have ended up selling a painting, and it might have just been a one-off. So, and
Right.
I might have still ended up going and doing more writing. So.
Right. Now, when you were talking about a moment ago that you like basically making a living. That is, I think, just about every writer's dream is to, I know it's mine, is basically what can I do to, can I write something that will not, I'm not looking to make Stephen King money, though I wouldn't fight that if the opportunity came up, but I would like to find something that will pay the rent, something that I can do that will help me, like that will allow me to write, but also at the same time will be something that can put groceries on the table, that could help us buy dishwashers that we wait for the cycle to end before an interview or something. Like inside baseball, folks, that's all. And so, like, there's that type of thing. But at the same time, you do strike me as someone that is incredibly, incredibly generous with your time. And I know that there are organizations that you really love to support, because like if anybody follows you on social media, they're going to see that you are a big animal advocate. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about how did you get into that? Like what drew you to a love of animals, and do you currently have any pets right now?
Well, to answer your second question first, no, I don't have any pets, which, you know, I'm kind of in an uncertain position right now, so I'm kind of not sure about committing to that, and I'm not sure I have the heart for the bad times, because I've, you know, had a lot of little nieces and nephews leave us, so, So I guess, but to go back to the first question, is one of the reasons why I, you know, try to put some effort into the animal advocacy and charities. I've always loved animals, and I think I'm more of an animal person than a person. If I, you know, people say, oh, I'd like my dog better than my husband or whatever, that's probably something that I would say.
Right.
You know, I think that they're the most precious creatures, and they are so pure of heart and spirit, unlike a lot of people. And we're responsible for them, and we owe them. And it is our responsibility to make sure that they're treated right. So I think what really somehow triggered this more so than I had before was I lived for a couple of years I was living in North Georgia, in the North Georgia mountains. Yes, they have mountains if you haven't been there. Appalachia. There was a rescue there called the TLC Humane Society in Dahlonega, Georgia. And I decided to do some volunteering there. And I would drive over maybe once or twice a week and just sort of hang out with the dogs, the little puppies and the smaller dogs, and walk them and just sort of, you know, love on them a bit. That kind of triggered it for me. And I thought, you know, I got involved, actually before that, I got involved with a Facebook group called Charlie to the Rescue Cross Posts. And I'm also an administrator on that. And that is a group where you just post, you know, animals that need rescue and just keep cross posting. And of course I do that on Twitter as well. So that kind of triggered it for me. And I do have several animal rescues, dog and cat rescues in the United States and in Britain that I try to donate to when I can and help, you know, promote through my platform as much as I possibly can. So really that's how it came about. And I will say that if there's anything left by the time I'm departing the world, it's my will is all for animal rescues.
Gotcha. Now, let me ask this, though. Considering everything going on with COVID-19 and forcing us to stay inside and everything, obviously money is going to be horrifyingly tight for a lot of people. I live in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania has now reached over 1 million unemployment people that have filed for unemployment because of all the silly COVID stuff that's happening. Is there something that can be done that to help out with animals and to help out with things that are in need, even though, like, hey, you know what, we don't have money or something like that, we don't have the money for it. Is there something that people can do? Can they repost things? Can they just encourage people, hey, contact your local ASPCA and help them out, that type of thing?
Yeah, I know. That's the big worry right now is you know, the donations are down, and that's a scary thing. A lot of shelters as well are not open to the public, so you have to kind of make a special appointment. I know a lot of rescues are trying to find more people to foster, so at least, you know, even if it's just a short-term thing, just to help out, to take in these animals into your home and look after them, especially during this crisis. I mean, fostering is something that is great anyways, but now they really need it. There's also things like a lot of people say, well, I can't afford to donate to a rescue. But, you know, sometimes there's things around your house that you could donate. Do you have an old blanket? Do you have some pillows? Do you have an old dog bed? I mean, all of these things, all cleaning supplies, like if you can get any.
Yeah.
But I mean, cleaning supplies, those are things that people can use. Even a sheaf of a ream of printing paper can be a useful thing that you could donate to a rescue. So, I mean, things like that. And as I say, cross-posting, you know, retweeting things on Twitter for dogs and cats and whatnot, other animals, posting them on your Facebook or whatever, just to help get the word out and do what you can. You know, those kind of things.
Right.
I mean, some of it's really, really easy. Like I said, about things you may have around the house that you've stored in the loft that you don't use anymore, that they can use at a shelter. I mean, when I had moved from my house that I had in North Georgia, I had a whole bunch of stuff that I carted over to TLC. You know, I had cleaning supplies. I had dust rags, you know, like good cloths that they can use. I had probably a few reams of printer paper I didn't need, you know, things like that, that they need for just business and just for just keeping things in order.
Right. I was going to ask if something like even old clothes, couldn't you use the old clothes, like cut them up, like especially now when people are saying like, here, make your own face mask. Couldn't you cut those up and use those for things to wrap up dogs that need to be wrapped up, or even just giving the material to people that can, like, hey, you know what, I can sew a sweater for this thing, or I could sew bandages or something like that.
I don't see why not. I mean, I would say you probably should check with an individual shelter to make sure that they will accept stuff like that, because I mean, to me, logically, it sounds like a good idea. But you know, sometimes if when in doubt, call or email and ask them, hey, you know, would you want something like this? Can you use it?
Right, exactly. Mitzi, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I really, really have enjoyed our conversation. You've just been so much fun to talk to, and I'm really glad that you took the time to come and join us today on Conversations of the Strange. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I really have enjoyed our conversation about how you came up with the anthology, working on it, and just went behind that. And you have just been, like I said, you've just been very accommodating to me, and I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I hope I wasn't too strange for Conversations of the Strange.
No. Conversations of the Strange, we're dedicated to talking with anybody about anything. So we can be, you can have strange people talking about normal things, or you can have normal people talking about strange things, all of the above, because we're just all a little bit strange. So
we are indeed. That's what makes life interesting.
Yeah, to quote the very famous philosopher Norman Bates, we all go a little mad sometimes. So.
Gotta love Norman, eh?
That you do.
That Norman.
Well, in the meantime, we will have links to Mitzi's site and also to the Amazon page where you can download the best new true crime stories. And we'll also have links to her Facebook page and her Twitter account, as well as her regular page. And but in the meantime, if you would like to go there one more time, her Facebook or her regular website is Mitzi Cerreto, that is spelled MitziZizereto.com. And you can see her, and you can see a picture of the very, very, very famous Teddy Tetelu, who's a crime fighter in his own right, and we want to thank him for his service as well too.
He says thanks. He's waving from the sofa.
Very nice. So anyway, Mitzi, I want to thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Don.
And everyone, thank you so much for listening, and hope you have a great day, and please stay safe. Take care.